Good evening. Welcome to Profiles. This is WFIU, and I'm Bob Willard, your host this evening. We're very fortunate to have as our guest Viola Taliaferro, Circuit Court Judge for the Monroe County. Viola, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Now, I'm going to get right to the heart of the matter. You are a black female from the South. How did you do it?
How did I do it? Well, I would like to be able to say that I did it because of some outstanding brilliance. But actually, it's more complicated in a way than that. I did what I have done mainly because I had two wonderful parents, and parents who supported me, my brothers and sisters, and who were able to help us overcome the racial conditions that existed when I was growing up. To state it another way, my parents never permitted us to feel sorry for ourselves. We never thought that we were victims. We knew that we were victimized to a degree by the legal system, by the racial conditions that existed at the time that I was growing up and still exist today in large part. But they always had goals and standards for themselves and for us. And I would say that's how I did it.
Well, what would those standards be then?
Well, first of all, education was very important in our family. And my father insisted that we achieve to the level of our potential. And he was a pretty good judge of that. So if he felt you could make an A and you came home with a B, you had to answer why. The other important part of my life when I was growing up is that my parents had what I would consider to be very good family values. They valued us as family members, and they were very interested in our upbringing. They took us to church every Sunday, whether we wanted to go or not. And we lived according to some basic Christian principles. Now, that's not to say that my brothers on occasion in particular didn't challenge that, but that was the environment in my home that I think has contributed in large part to the things that I've tried to do in my life.
Were your parents well-educated?
My parents were as well-educated as black people could be, generally speaking, in the South. They were able to get six grades of education, and my father did get two more grades in adult education. That education was not high on the list for black children when my parents were growing up.
And this is in Virginia?
This is in Virginia, yes.
How many brothers and sisters?
I had four brothers and three sisters. All of my brothers are dead now, but I'm the youngest of eight.
Youngest of eight.
Yes.
How many went on then? Did you all graduate from high school?
Everyone graduated from high school, and three of us graduated from college. In fact, all of my brothers and sisters did some post-secondary work. So education has always been very important in my family.
Obviously, it was a high priority and value in the family.
Oh, very much so, because our nieces and nephews have, I think with the exception of two, have gotten college degrees, and several of them have professional degrees. My husband and I have four daughters, and our four daughters graduated from IU, and I have a law degree from IU, and my husband has a degree from IU. So we are an IU family.
I would say so. Can we sort of take a trip with you through your life to how you got to Bloomington and to be sitting on the bench today?
Well, I was born in Evanston, Virginia. It's a small community about 9-10 miles south of Lynchburg, Virginia. I went to public school in my county, Campbell County. And after graduating from high school, I went to Virginia State College in Petersburg, Virginia, majored in business administration. When I graduated from college, I went to Tuskegee Institute and worked there for 2 years. And then I went to Washington, D.C. and worked at Howard University for about a year and a half until I was married. After I was married, my husband and I we stayed for a short while in Washington, D.C. He was playing professional football at that time. And we moved to Dallas, and we were in Dallas for about 6 months. And then we moved to Los Angeles, and we lived there for about 2 years. And then when my husband was traded to the Baltimore Colts, or rather when he joined the Baltimore Colts organization, we moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and lived there until 1972 when we came to Bloomington, Indiana. And we have been here ever since.
So you've been around the country a little bit.
We've been around the country.
You were working during some of this time.
Yes. Well, beginning in Baltimore, I did social work for about 6 years with the Department of Welfare. And then I directed a senior citizen center in Baltimore for 1 year. I went to Morgan State University to get my teaching certificate, and then I became a teacher, a high school teacher, as a matter of fact, in the Baltimore Public Schools for 3 years, and then I became a department head. And I continued working in the high schools until we moved to Bloomington in 72.
You've been in a lot of positions where you've been helping people then, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Well, certainly in a lot of positions where I've been trying to help people.
Okay. You have been in the process of helping.
I have been trying.
Okay.
I'll leave it that way.
When you're dealing with things like welfare and with high school students, and as you have in that little block of period of time, there have to be some frustrations. What did you learn from those?
Well, I learned a lot about the ability of people to survive under adverse conditions, particularly when I was working at the welfare department. It was quite a shock to find out that people could live in such poor conditions and still survive. But one of the things that I found out is that no matter how hard I worked as a social worker, there were still poor people, and I was doing virtually nothing to make a dent in poverty and in the poor conditions that many people live in. So I felt that perhaps education would be a better job and would give me a better opportunity to work with certainly the younger people and families. And I'm not so sure that that was such a noble undertaken. It was not entirely done for that reason. I left social work and began teaching because I had three children at that time, and four children. No, we had all of them had been born. I wanted to have the same holidays as my children had. I wanted to be with my children during the summertime. But I also felt that education was so very important, particularly for one segment of our society, people who are poor and live in poor conditions.
You came from that kind of condition, though, in a way, didn't you?
Well, I didn't come from a poor condition.
No.
But I came from a racially based condition, and one where the schools were segregated, and there was certainly a vast difference in the high school I attended and the high school that was available for white children in my community.
You told me before we had a chance to talk here on the air that there were two things that I remember. One of them was that you said you were never told that you could not achieve, and you said you never saw yourself as an inferior human.
That's right.
Now, is this something you try to instill in the people, were trying to instill in the people you were dealing with?
Well, no, I didn't have time to do that, because when I was doing social work, it was processing cases and giving people money. But when I was dealing with the children in high school, certainly I dealt with them and talked to them about their worth and tried to help them overcome attitudes that people had about them, not just because of their race, but maybe because of their family income level, or maybe because of the way they looked. I mean, we have, as human beings, we have a myriad of prejudices. It's not just race. Race is an awful one to overcome. But we've been fairly successful in discriminating against people for all sorts of reasons, the way they look, their handicaps, where they live.
But you can't eradicate all of that, can you?
No, you cannot. But I do believe that if you are in the position to make a difference in someone's life, that you should take it.
So that's been a sort of a hallmark of what you've done through your life?
Seems that way.
Well, now, let's take a little bit of a break here. This is heavy stuff. Why don't we listen to some music and relax back a little bit? What would you like to play for us?
Oh, Brahms' First Symphony.
Oh, just the whole thing?
No, maybe the third movement.
Okay, let's do that. The third movement of the Brahms Symphony No. 1. We have just heard the third movement of the Brahms Symphony No. 1, played by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. It was a selection of our guest today, Viola Taliaferro. Viola, why that piece?
It's just so beautiful and rhythmic, and it makes me feel good.
Okay, well, that's a great reason. All right, now, you've met the great pro football player. What was it like during that period of your life when his career was so active? And it seems to me that you moved around a lot and so forth.
Well, we did move around a lot. When George and I married, he was playing in New York with a team called the New York Yanks. What was it like? It was very challenging for me because I was not accustomed to celebrity, and I was not interested in getting caught up in that world. So I did the very best that I could to raise my children in a real world as if George were not a celebrity. Well, we had a lot of very interesting experiences, particularly when we were living in Dallas. And the Cotton Bowl, where he played his games, was segregated with black players, black fans sitting in the end zone and whites in the better seats.
This is in the early 50s?
This was in 52.
Okay. And they still were doing that?
Oh, yes. And then I was asked if I would join the White Wives, and I refused. I sat where black people were able to sit. But it was an interesting experience. And one of the things I wanted to do, particularly as far as the children were concerned, was to keep them as far removed from that kind of life as I could. I didn't want people hanging around my house because they wanted to be around George. He had plenty of opportunity to meet them at other times and places. But it was a very good experience for him. And I think he did quite well as a pro player. I was very proud of him. Went to all of the games and spent a good deal of time with the wives and attended all the social functions. But I wanted to keep our life separate and apart from that as much as possible.
Then you went from Dallas to Los Angeles?
Yes. We lived in Los Angeles for 2 years. We had planned to live in Los Angeles. We had not planned to move. And no matter where George played, we thought that we would continue to live in Los Angeles. But the freeway took our house, and so we were in Baltimore at that time, and we just decided to stay in Baltimore.
Okay, so then you went to Baltimore.
Yes.
And that's where you were a social worker and a teacher.
And a department head.
And
yes.
A department head, and he's still playing with the Colts.
He played with the Colts for 2 years, maybe, after we moved to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. But by that time, our oldest daughter was ready to go to school, so we needed to put down some roots, and we found that Baltimore was an excellent place to live and to raise children. So we made a lot of friends in Baltimore and had a fine church there and had great experiences. And I still have very fond feelings for Baltimore.
but you came to Bloomington.
Came to Bloomington in 1972 when George took a job in President Ryan's office and moved our family out here. And our oldest daughter was already a senior in college here and just picked up everything, took our third daughter, who was a senior, was ready to enter her senior year of high school in Columbia, Maryland, and brought her here. And she had to finish her last year of high school in Bloomington. And that was traumatic for her because she wanted to stay with her friends. But our youngest daughter, when we moved here, was 9 years old. So really, Bloomington is basically the only home she's ever known. Mm-hmm.
Then when you're in Bloomington, is that when you decided to go to law school?
Yes, it is.
Why did you make that decision?
Well, I have thought about law school off and on during my life. And I've always been interested in the law. I've always been perplexed also why, despite the wonderful Constitution and Bill of Rights and all the laws we have, that still some of us are treated differently in this society. But just the order, the laws are so important to the order of our society and to our safety that I was just drawn to it. And also because I just like to debate. I've done that for years. But started out very young with my dad engaging me in debates, political debates, when I was a very young child, as young as 5 years old. So. And I was on the debate team when I was in high school.
Now, your father did this.
My father did this.
Did you have different political views when you
were
5 years old?
We had very different political views. My father, as a matter of fact, was a Republican, and my mother was a Democrat, which made life very interesting when elections rolled around. My dad paid the poll tax religiously and would always challenge my mother before they went to a primary to, you know, how are you going to vote, Mary? And she said, Richard, that's my business. And when the Democrats won, as they always did, he'd say, well, you know, if you just vote Republican, it would be all right. And my mother would say, well, you can change your party anytime you want to. So that kind of spirit independence that my folks had was always quite interesting to watch.
Sounds to me like your mother had a little steel there, too.
My mother had quite a bit of steel. She was a rather quiet lady, and it was... It was interesting that many people would think that she didn't have a lot of willpower, but all you had to do was challenge a position that she held, and you'd find out in a second that she stood for, she believed in what she believed in, and she would stand up for it.
So good-natured, educated debate was part of your just upbringing.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That was that and lots of mental arithmetic problems that my dad would throw at us, long division that we had to do mentally and... He was just so good in math.
When you went to law school, what was your dream? I mean, what did you expect to do once you got your degree?
Oh, I planned to practice law. That was my goal when I went to law school.
Okay, but what area did you have anything in
mind? Well, you know, I thought that I would probably do criminal law, and then after I'd been in law school for a while, I thought that I would do civil rights law. And then when I came out and started practicing, I was happy to have clients, and I did whatever I was capable of doing. And I had a general practice. We're not permitted to specialize in the state of Indiana. But basically, when I was practicing for the 12 years that I practiced, I did family law and criminal law mostly.
And then you were appointed to the bench?
I was named as a magistrate in 1989, and in 1995, I was appointed as judge by Governor Bay.
And then
I ran for election in 1998.
In the courts, what is your specific area that you were identified with?
Circuit court judges have general jurisdiction, meaning that we can hear any kind of case, and there are 7 judges in Monroe, circuit court judges in Monroe County. And we've divided the work up this way. I do all of the juvenile work, which is juvenile delinquency, juvenile chins, meaning cases brought by the welfare department, and paternity cases, and I do all of probate and the mental health commitments. And the other cases are divided equally among the other 6 judges.
And then you deal with some really specific things with children's problems, parental problems with their children, et cetera.
Oh, yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit for us?
There are two kinds of cases involving children. One would be the delinquency cases where the children have broken a law, and they come in that door. Then there's another door, and that's when the parents come in because they have abused or neglected their children, or the children need help for some reason because of the parents' failure or because parents cannot afford the kind of help for children that they should have. There's a lot of similarity between those two groups, however. I think that just we could just have one cause of action. And I could just deal with these cases because many of these children, no matter whether they come in as delinquent children or children brought in by the welfare department, have very similar backgrounds.
Can you?
Well, many of them come from dysfunctional homes where the parents abuse drugs or alcohol. There are abusive relationships. Sometimes the families are just, there's no structure in the family and children know no boundaries. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them come from poor homes and they have inadequate housing. They don't have insurance. They don't always go to school. The children are truant and maybe the parents haven't been to school.
Is it a cause and effect situation then for the children?
Well, and yes, many times that is so.
So there really aren't, the children aren't bad.
I don't think that there are bad children. They're children who do bad things. And there's a distinct difference between those two views. If we believe that a person is bad, then it doesn't make any difference whether he or she changes behavior or not because it's a bad person. But if we believe that people can change, and can do something positive with their lives or can reach their potential, then everyone who's in contact with that person, if you hold that belief, will help that person make a change. But it's still up to the individual to make the change. But if we believe that certain people in our society are bad, worthless, of no value, then we have excluded them. And there's no earthly reason why they should pay any attention to our social mores.
Don't you have some strong feelings about some of the early parts of the Constitution?
Very strong feelings about the early parts of the Constitution.
You mentioned that something happened in high school like that to me earlier.
Yes. I was one of the honor graduates, and when I made my speech, the theme or the topic was about the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and I just wondered why, despite those amendments, I was graduating from a segregated school and living in a segregated society. I believe in the dignity of people. And I do not believe that we should treat people differently because of skin color and because of intelligence and because of size and shape and all of the other things we use to make differences.
And we're all good in God's eyes.
Well, that's what we all say we believe. That's what most of us say we believe in. And I certainly do not feel that there's anything that justifies a racist society.
We have to sit back again. We've gotten to this enough. What else would we be privileged to hear?
The New World Symphony, any part of it. The beginning I love in particular.
Okay, let's listen to the opening movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony. have just heard the first movement of the Dvorak Symphony No. 9, the New World Symphony, conducted by Herbert von Karajan with the Berlin Philharmonic. It was a selection of our guest today, Viola Taliaferro, who is the circuit court judge for Monroe County, and we've been visiting with her about her history. Now I want to talk about beliefs. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have had experience overcoming a lot of tough obstacles. You have seen a lot of tough things in your life. And I would assume that's built up a set of code of ethics, a code of beliefs, or things that you consider givens in your life. Are there any of those that you could share with us?
Well, you know, I've never given this a lot of thought, so I'll take a stab at it. I don't believe that I have changed my basic beliefs very much from early childhood. And my parents had quite an influence, or rather shaped my beliefs in many ways. My folks were Christian people who believed in Christian principles, and that is what I believe in. I believe in the dignity of people. I believe in the right of people to have some self-expression. I believe that people should have the right to reach their potential without being stymied based on gender, race, poverty, or rather lack of money, or tons of money. And I believe that we should treat each other with humanity. And by that, I mean that we should value other people's lives and their safety and their security as much as we can. And we shouldn't violate people just for our personal reasons. We shouldn't condemn people or criticize people in order to make ourselves feel better or feel superior. I think it's a lot simpler than we make it. It's sort of like the golden rule. I don't think we need to go past that.
Just do for others what you want them to do for you, or do unto. Well, let me carry it and be more specific here. Now, you've raised four daughters.
Four lovely daughters.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about what they're doing and then any advice you might have to young women?
All right. Our oldest daughter, Linda, lives in Louisville, Kentucky. She has three children, two boys, Micah, Joey, and a daughter, Danielle. We finally did get a granddaughter. And she works as a social worker. She works for the Louisville Public Schools and does family programming in connection with that school.
Now, do I hear some heritage here? Social work in an education facility?
Yes. Okay. Our next daughter, Renee, lives in Cincinnati. She and her husband, Lauren, have no children. And she has worked with Delta Airlines for 26 years, graduated from Indiana University and was going to take a couple of years off, and then she was going to go into law school. Well, she's still flying and enjoying it very much. Our third daughter, Donna, lives in Shaker Heights, Ohio. She has two sons, and she works for a locally based company. She works for Cook.
Okay.
And our youngest daughter, Terry, lives in Dallas and has two children, Raymond and, I didn't mention Ryan and Lauren's names. They're the ones who live in Shaker Heights. They'd be very angry if they heard a tape of this and I hadn't mentioned their names. And but back to Terry in Dallas, Raymond and our second granddaughter, Laura. Terry works for Quaker Oats.
Okay. Now, after all of these daughters you had, it's nice to see some sons coming up.
Well, we were delighted to have the grandsons. In fact, my husband was just overjoyed. But then after the third grandson, he said, well, it would be nice to have a granddaughter. We are very fortunate because they're all very fine people.
Well, now, if you were to give advice, the advice you gave your daughters, what would you give to people today, too?
Well, I certainly encourage people to think for themselves and to chart their own courses rather than letting someone else do it for them. In other words, I would encourage young women not to listen to people who tell them that there are things they can't do because they're women. I would encourage young women to be as active as parents, as professional people, as they can be. And there should be no restrictions on them because of their sex. There should be no restrictions on them because they have children. And they certainly should not be relegated to an inferior status because they're not men. We have women who have accomplished wonderful things. We have women who have been astronauts. We have women who are medical doctors. We have women who are lawyers, judges, teachers, mothers, you know, referees. I can't think of anything that women can't do if they have the qualifications. They should not be prevented from doing anything they've trained to do, they've learned to do, simply because they're women. So we must help men overcome this feeling that women cannot be successful. That's my greatest advice to women, is help the men understand that we're people also. And they have to give up this feeling that there are things we can't do because we're women.
Is there anything that you'd just like to share with us before we finish the program today? This has been so wonderful.
I would just like all of us to think of this society as one that is inclusive and not exclusive, and that we consider the needs of all people, and that we use our resources so that we benefit every segment of our society. And I'm not talking about giveaway programs, but when we make policy decisions, I hope that we will care as much about a child who lives in a poor neighborhood as we do about a child who lives in the richest suburb.
You know, it's very fitting that you should have picked the final movement of Beethoven's Ninth as the last piece of music because of the words where he talks about the brotherhood of people and about how you can achieve all things. What a wonderful and fitting ending to a wonderful time together. We will now hear, as we finish the program, the Ninth Symphony, the final movement's excerpt from it, of Beethoven. Our guest today has been Viola Taliaferro, Circuit Court Judge in Monroe County. I'm Bob Willard. This is Profiles, and you're listening to WFIU. And just thank you so much for being with us this evening. And thank you, Viola, for being here.
Thank you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in February of 1999. Production assistance came from John Shelton, Michael Paskash, and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.